I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to Bookish. I'm George DeMorelis. This is a show where we ask you what's your story and what does it say about you. Today on the show, we have an international expert on prose poetry, as well as a critic and scholar of the form. She's a visiting scholar in English at Harvard University, as well as a visiting fellow at Sophia University in Tokyo, and is currently an associate professor at Deakin University. Cassandra Atherton, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. You know, I love to talk about prose poetry. So if you give me the opportunity to do that, I could run on for days.
Yeah, because you write it yourself as well as, I guess, critiquing it or analyzing it.
Yeah, yeah. So I analyze it as well as being a practitioner, because I think that they both feed into one another. Like, I think you've got to do it to be able to analyze it as well.
100%. That's actually the reason I tried to improve my cooking.
I love cooking.
Oh, that's the same thing. You can't have any idea until you've done it yourself, I reckon. But that's cool. So this is like, first, thanks for being on. But I guess this is like going to be quite informative for me, because I'll be honest, my prose poetry knowledge is, I reckon, lacking a bit. So you could teach me a lot.
That's good. That's a good place to start from. I like to convert all people to prose poetry.
Okay. Well, I guess, so prose poetry.
Mm-hmm. What is it? That's what you're going to say, right? What is it?
No. That's what I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, look, I think that it's a good question, because there's huge debates about it, so you're not far wrong. Even if you think you don't know that much about prose poetry, you're still going to ask the same questions that's going on in scholarship about the form. I think the easiest thing to say is that it's a poem that's written in sentences and paragraphs rather than in lines and stanzas. But that's kind of oversimplifying things in a way. One of the things I love about it, you know, is this box shape on the page. So most prose poems have that fully justified box and set against the white page or the screen or whatever you're writing on. And, it's been compared to a little brick, you know, because it can really make an impact. It's been compared to a number of quotidian sort of boxes, you know, like pillows and cheese graters and all kinds of things that seem to be part of everyday experience. And I think that's because it connects a lot with the fact that we write in sentences. So we see sentences around us everywhere all day. We don't necessarily think of them as poetry. So not only does the block of text kind of look approachable, that's one of the reasons that I kind of love it, especially if I'm teaching it, because students will often say, oh, I hate poetry, I don't understand it. So you kind of give them a prose poem. They don't think it's a poem. They start reading it and then they get halfway through and they're like, oh, no, it's a poem. You tricked me. But then they finish it and then they like it and they talk about it. So somehow that block on the page is less confronting for a reader in many ways. But, you know, it's considered a fragment. It reaches beyond itself to take on meaning. It's compressed. Women have talked about the box, the prose poetry box, being great to talk about, you know, the constraints of, domesticity and exploding from the box and all of those kinds of wonderful metaphors about being confined and being liberated. So, you know, it packs a pretty big punch for a little block of text on the page.
Right. Okay. So I didn't even know the specification of the box shape. That's interesting already. That's a and it could be anything, right? Like as in the topics and the whatever. It's just anything. Is that?
Yep. Absolutely. So there is some variety that's going on now where I prefer the ones that are fully justified, so they have that perfect sort of margin the whole way around. Some people prefer to keep their right margin ragged as a way of sort of talking about the way that things are kind of connected to other things and not perfectly and seamlessly put together, if you like. There are what's called freeline poems, prose poems, where they have little moments where there are sentences that are on their own and sort of drag the box into like a larger space. But they're all, for me, they're all different ways of expressing the box. Like they all come back to the box. that's sort of where it comes from, I think, in terms of the experimentation. But one of the things I like about it, because it really is quite approachable, people can write either really darkly comic things in there, and the Americans are great at doing that, that kind of neo-surreal tradition of being, you know, really funny. Or you can actually write quite political things in there because people wade into them before they realize, and the fact they're easily disseminated and that you might get a broader audience reading them because they're not identifying them as poems straight away. So, you know, people lobby for all kinds of things in prose poetry. So it's right. And people have called it a subversive form. So I think it can be read like that.
Right. And did you, I guess to go for you, did you always like it, or did you develop there slowly, or how did your relationship with prose poetry start?
I started writing it before I really knew what I was doing. So I was in my teens and I'd write little fragments of things, and I'd prefer to write in sentences rather than, if I thought I was writing a poem, you know, to write in lines that sort of stopped before the right margin. And then I didn't quite know what to do because no one would invite me to things because they didn't know that what I was writing. Some people would say, oh, sorry, you're writing fiction, so you should go hang out with the fiction writers. And then the fiction writers would say, no, look, you know, I think this is poetry. You know, we don't want you here either. So for a long time, for many years, for a decade, I ping-ponged between the two. And when I submitted prose poetry to journals, I'd often have the editor say, oh no, this isn't poetry, send it to the fiction editor. And then the fiction editor would say, oh no, you should send it to the poetry editor. And you'd be like, well, just done that. So I think it took a while in Australia for it to really proliferate, but it's having just the most huge renaissance at the moment. Most poetry books in Australia that you open will have at least one prose poem, and we're getting whole books of prose poetry as well now, which is exciting.
Yeah, but because it seems almost it's funny, like the details and stuff you're talking about as well, because like to people outside of it, they'll be like, what? It's like ragged lines and that's the whole thing. But like, obviously that's a big detail. But like the part that I think is interesting is it seems like such an obvious, like from what you've described, like idea essentially, because you are taking the focus on language and the beauty of words essentially of what I would consider poetry and the use of imagery and visuals. So like very, it's a concise system of writing essentially, and just doing it in prose form instead of rhyming. So it doesn't seem that.
No, yeah. I think it's challenging because there's quite an elitist attitude to those lines that stop before the right margin. You know, they'll have a weightiness about them because they have all this space around them, and we read them differently. And we even read them sometimes in quite an elevated, you know, poetry launchy kind of voice. Whereas the thing I like about prose poetry is that it says that there is, you know, poetic ways of speaking that don't have to be elevated. It's just the speech we use every day has its own rhythm and cadence. It's a different one from a lot of lineated poetry, but it's an important one. You know, we're denying the poetic of kind of speaking to one another if we think that it can't be expressed in any way except, you know, through short stories or through creative nonfiction or through other forms. Poetry is allowed to speak about the everyday, and it's allowed to do it in sentences and paragraphs.
Yeah, that's a part which, I mean, people are just like, what is it then? Like, is it? It's just talking. Like, is it? So, I could see how people would fall into that a little bit, but I think, and this is something because I came to poetry quite late, and I still am. Got no idea, essentially. But
you don't sound like you're faking it so well.
Well, that's the thing. I've learned. I'm doing the opposite. Rather than doing it, I'm just like trying to learn enough to get by, just to fake it in the right crowds.
Fake it till you make it, right?
Yeah. I've memorized a few quatrains. I think I'm covered.
He's always throwing a quatrain. It's very convincing.
Exactly. That's why I get those people, because I've kind of come into the same way, which is like, And it's something I've been very late, and I've discussed it actually a previous guest as well. It's like when I read, a lot of the time I don't have that kind of laser focus on the use of words, which I think I'm slowly appreciating more and more just how deep that well is, like never ending that is. Once you start being like, oh, this word, because this letter actually, this D goes with this word over here. This like is in that level of detail is like just crazy to me.
It's true. It depends what you're reading too, though. I think I usually say to my students when they're reading any form of poetry that it takes about, you know, the same time as it would take to read a paragraph in a novel to understand one line of poetry, not to just read it in 1 second and think that they'll get it, or, you know, that it's not perhaps difficult or a bit opaque to begin with. And once you kind of tell them they've got to put in the time and slow down, then it becomes a little bit easier, I think, and less confronting, because I think they read it and they're like, I don't get it. And you're like, that's okay. You read it in 30 seconds. I wouldn't expect you to get it all. So it's sort of about a different way of reading, I think, than reading prose fiction or even nonfiction.
Yeah. Because the focus is just kind of completely different, I guess. It is that thing where it's like it's taking, I guess now thinking about it, it is more like turning, it's the art version. It's almost like a painting. You don't just scan a painting and then move on. You actually sit there and you're meant to just look at it for a while to take it all in. So I guess in that sense. So that's interesting though. So you're saying that you would like kind of there wasn't that space that much in Australia. Is that because Australia, and I'm, look, we could be honest, probably Australia was probably a bit behind some other places around the world.
Australia sort of developed it in the kind of 70s with a lot of the men in universities who were informed sometimes by the Americans, sometimes by what was going on in Europe. And they started off by calling it poetic prose, which for me is quite different because poetic prose isn't poetry. It's, you know, prose, but it's a poetic way of responding, and poetic prose is often quite long. There's huge punch-ons in the prose poetry world based on how long prose poetry should be, right? It's pretty insane. Some people argue that it's, you know, a prose poem can be, you know, a few pages, more, longer. John Ashbery's prose poems are quite long. We would say that prose poetry really needs to be no more than one page because the visual of it is really important. And if you have to turn the page, then you're losing that compression and that initial response to it visually as well as being able to read it. But yeah, I mean, there's endless conversations and arguments about it, but that's where I come from on that. But yeah, so it's about the guys who decided that they wanted to sort of start a tradition in Australia by writing poetic prose, or prose pieces, sometimes they were calling them, and it sort of developed from there a little bit. And then one of our best proponents, I guess, was Gary Catalano, who was really devoted to the form, and he wrote whole books of prose poetry, and that sort of was quite exciting. And then, of course, there was so many women. So then there's been huge input by Australian women prose poets who in many ways I think were more important than the men for what they did and how they experimented with the box of prose poetry. So Joanne Burns obviously is a pretty incredible person who explores quite a lot about prose poetry and hybrid forms and inside the box and outside the box. She's always working in these kinds of traditions of prose poetry and looking at sort of gendered responses to them as well. Anna Kawani, there's a range of really amazing, Anya Vulvich, who sadly died not so long ago, you know, she also had her own unique style with prose poetry, and these women kind of shook up what was happening with poetic prose and prose pieces, and they're like, no, this is prose poetry and we're writing it, and, you know, we're going to keep the tradition going and take it further than it has been.
So with someone like that, when you say they've come in and done that, do you mean that both in terms of, like, this is me not understanding how it all works,
but
like in terms of the language used in it, or more in terms of the topic and the structure of it, or also just in terms of the actual way they shaped the sentences, I guess. Like, I don't know. Is that what you mean?
I think what they did was they decisively said it's prose poetry, and that Australians had to, they were mostly men who were writing prose pieces or poetic prose, and they said, no, this is prose poetry. There's a tradition of prose poetry we're writing into. We acknowledge who they were. I mean, obviously the French tradition, we would say, is the most important tradition. Of course, the French do it well and do it first.
I've got no idea about that.
So the French started it. Well, the French were just like, you know what, speech can be beautiful and sentences can be beautiful and poetic, and we're ignoring the rebellion that we can put in place with the verse or lineated poetry, so we can write something different that's going to shake people up. So they sort of looked at prose poetry as being rebellious, that they were saying, I'm writing poetry, but it's in sentences. And people are like, I don't know about that. And they're like, yeah, read it. It's poetry. And when you read it, yeah, it is poetry. So Baudelaire started that with Paris Spleen. So he kind of walked around the city and he wrote about the city. He wrote it in these little paragraphs, and it's clearly poetry, and it's really poetic. And so the tradition generally stems from there. And
how long ago was that?
So you're looking, 1869 is when Baudelaire started it, but he kind of took from this guy called Aloysius Bertrand, who wrote what's considered to be the first lot of prose poetry in 1842.
So I really feel
pretty
like,
long time ago.
I really feel like your voice almost changed into like teacher mode. You're like,
and this mode. The history of prose poetry is as follows. Yes.
Yeah.
So a lot of Australians were, I guess, sort of saying, oh, not really sure what we're doing. And a lot of the women sort of came into that circle and said, we're working with this form that has all of these really interesting ways of expressing themselves. Let's not avoid calling them poems. Let's call them prose poems. I mean, that's a generalization. There were some women who went along with it and said, you know, still call them prose pieces or poetic prose. But I think a lot of the revolution of prose poetry and its advancement, if you like, because it was sort of going around in circles and people were writing these things and no one really knew what they were. And I think, you know, there were sort of women who injected themselves into this this moment in time and really got it going and really established what it was and gave it its shape and its form and, yeah, the kinds of things that it would express.
They defined it and then made it actually able to be part of the even larger global conversation.
Absolutely. And to let people join in and then be like, right, who's writing now? Who's going to write after us or with us or continue the tradition and how will it change and those sorts of things?
Yeah. I mean, that's fair enough. That's interesting.
It's exciting. It's actually exciting to see.
I just want to know if I was going to be like, what's the most famous prose poem? What's like the most famous, I guess?
The most famous Australian prose poem?
Yeah.
Biggest,
however you want to phrase it, or the best.
Look, probably
you
the
can
one
be totally
that,
biased.
No, I can be totally biased. I'd say Anya Wallwich wrote she wrote two really significant ones, and they're often taught in secondary schools, so people know them. And I'm getting excited that students are coming through and they have encountered the prose poem largely through Wallwich. She's written a really cheeky one about Little Red Riding Hood that is that's quite feminist, and Little Red Riding Hood gets her own back at the end. But she's also written one about being an immigrant and coming to Australia, which talks about, you know, she says, Australia, you big ugly, you didn't invite us into the country, you weren't, you know, all of those kinds of really difficult processes of finding and making a new life in a country are brought to the fore in what is a really amusing way, but at the same time a really devastating way too. And so there are a lot of criticisms in that. So, yeah, I mean, those two Anya Wallwich poems would probably be the most well-known ones, the most pithy ones, I guess.
Okay. So I'm just trying to find one that I can memorize and then look like I know all prose poetry.
That's it. The Little Red Riding one's quite short, so I think it's called Little Red. Yeah.
Little Red? Look it up. So to go back to your journey, I guess, as part of this, you liked it, you like even in adolescence, and then you went to university, I'm guessing you studied English or something like that, and then you...
Yeah, I did, yeah.
But this was always in the back of your mind, this is the focus you wanted to go in this direction?
Yeah, like even at university, there wasn't really anyone writing prose poetry. I had Chris Wallace Crabb, the Australian poet Chris Wallace Crabb, in my second year in my undergraduate. I did literature and creative writing, and so he taught me, and he has written one of the first kind of prose poems as well. But didn't I sort of came to the history of prose poetry, I guess, myself, rather than through anyone in the university system. I still felt a little bit like I was eccentric for writing prose poetry at the time. So I didn't have so many prose poetry buddies to get together and, you know, have sleepovers and that kind of thing. It was more a feeling that because I didn't fit, I had to find out what was going on, because, you know, because nothing is new or original. Someone's always done it first. So I didn't think, oh, I've created this new form. It's like, where are all these people that must have written this in varying, you know, forms? And, you know, it sort of just took a while. So, yeah, so I was sort of submitting prose poetry as part of my creative writing degree, and I was writing about prose poetry in my literature degree and those sorts of things, but I wasn't sort of putting it together in my own life and being able to kind of find other Australians writing prose poetry. I think it's much easier now. You know, I think it's a lot easier now. But back then it still seemed a little bit like the poets weren't that invested in prose poetry because it was too quotidian, or because it used the sentence, or because there was snobbery attached to it. I still think there's snobbery attached to it. I think there's a lot of people who think that, you know, lineated poetry is real poetry, or verse is real poetry, and prose poetry is just something else, you know.
Yeah. That seems people still do that?
Yeah.
I thought that stuff would have been done by now. Everyone.
No, you know what they've said, prose poetry in not prose poetry, they've said in Australia, the poetry community, you know, can be quite difficult, and it's almost like a knife fight in a telephone box. And, you know, I have to say, like, it can be, you know, it can be pretty full on, because it's quite a small kind of passionate community with everyone sort of fighting for what they want, and different schools of thought on things, and different people allied to people. So, yeah, it's a bit confronting.
It sounds like you've gone through some stuff with it, but it's just amazing. Anyone outside of it would be like, what, the poetry community is cutthroat?
Yeah, I know.
Like a knife fight in a telephone box? What?
Yeah, I think we like to think we're more important than we are as well. I think all poets are a little bit narcissistic.
Sorry. Yeah, it's, you know, like my words will change the world.
Yeah, and it's like they're in this, you know, I should say we, because I'm part of it, but, you know, we think we're in this kind of, you know, important field, and we are, but there's also a certain amount of being in a rose-coloured bubble, maybe, where we think everybody's on board in the same way that we are.
And especially because I'm guessing, like every field, you're interacting mainly with people within that field. How important are we? Oh, we are pretty important.
Yeah, we're like so important. We're writing poetry books and people are reading them. Yeah, largely other poets are reading poetry books rather than, you know, them setting the world on fire and reaching a really broad audience, which would be nice to think that we could. I mean, Amanda Gorman, for instance, you know, in her reading the poem at both at the Super Bowl and as part of the, you know, presidential campaign is huge. And I think that's what people think, oh, poetry is relevant, and it is. It's just there are very few of those moments where it reaches, you know, a massive
public. Where everyone else hears the word poet and they're like, what?
Yeah, I'll just go get a drink. Yeah. You know, oh, the poem, it will turn it over. It's like a commercial maybe on TV.
Because the logic of it is sound. Like, I mean, ultimately, I mean, language. It's like everyone, like, it's beautiful and it's so powerful. Yeah. It's what we all interact with. So it makes sense why it would have appeal, I think. But I love it just because I think the importance of a topic, we can all fall into the trait in whatever we're in of trying to make it the most important thing in the world, but it's like the most important thing is if you're loving it and you're focused on it, that's always the big thing. That's why I'm so interested in.
Definitely. And I think with poetry, you know, even people who say they don't enjoy poetry or they don't understand it, well, most of the weddings and funerals I go to, they read poetry. And when we have these huge catastrophic, you know, moments in time, like think about 9/11, all the poetry that came out of, you know, the tragedy of 9/11 and the poetry that comes out of any very emotional period, people turn to poetry. They don't so much, you know, get to write a novel. I mean, those come with time, but it's the intense kind of compression and the way that the expression and emotion speaks to people in these, you know, hugely important times in their life that they want to recite and learn and carry with them.
That's actually a very, very good point. Like, as in it's you want it to be something short. Well, again, it's going back to the idea of like the art, like painting or something like that. It's like it's capturing that moment and just that. So you can't. Yeah, I guess it's almost like being like, oh, why do you need paintings when you can watch a movie? Like, they're just so completely different. Exactly. And the one just captures that snapshot, I guess, much better because of its shortness, essentially.
Yeah. And it's often, you know, something that will reach larger audiences. I mean, I'm so focused on audience because I would like prose. I would like prose poetry in particular to have a huge audience and appeal. But poetry, because it can often be quite short, is often on social media, and that's great. If someone puts something up on social media, a photo of a poem or have typed out part of a poem or a prose poem, then it reaches a broader appeal. Even if people don't read it, they catch something of it and starts to become a little bit more kind of normalized as part of everyday life, which is how I would like it to continue to proliferate.
So that's so I got into that with your it's funny because from your description you were like you had a very, very small audience when you first started out of just you.
just me on my own writing prose poems. I think people just seem to be writing, a range of more kind of formal poetry. I came through in a class that was more interested in writing things like sonnets, which are so hard to write and so are their own little
box
on the page.
It's like they don't want anyone to read it.
Well, I mean, sonnets are hard things to do well in a contemporary moment too, I think, because we think about Shakespeare and we think of, courtly love and all of those things. But there have been some really fantastic your reinterpretations. There's also prose poem sonnets, which are a little bit contentious because it's like, well, do you count the number of sentences as equivalent to the number of lines in a sonnet, or is it how they appear on the page? Because, it's not necessarily one sentence to a line, so they run across. So is it counting the spaces on the page? Anyway, people have had a lot of different goes at it.
Yeah, this is so amazing. Like, detail most people would just not even think about with something like this. That's why because it's how you can appreciate something more, I think.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Oh, actually, to that point, though, in terms of, for me to kind of grasp it. So with you, when you're writing it, we are jumping around a bit, but
just popped
into my head. When you're writing it, do you start off with a topic you want to do, or do you, how long would one take, I guess, and what's involved in it?
Gosh, look, I've got friends that smash them out in 7 minutes on their iPhones, and they can be fantastic. I think everyone's different. I'm a slow writer. I'm slow in terms of how long it takes me to get something I'm really happy with. I think generally what happens is a line, an idea for something will pop into my head, and then I'll sort of create a sentence out of it. It might just be a little fragment of an idea, and then a sentence comes to me that fits beautifully. Often it's the first line. For me personally, I struggle more with the final line. So the final line in a prose poem is so important, right? It's the last thing someone reads, and it has to really open out rather than shut itself down. So you're looking for that moment that is like a balloon sort of taking off rather than it being a, I don't know, stone dropped in a river. Like it's sort of got to have more meaning that you can think about it long after you've finished reading it than to sort of close it all off or close it all down. And so those end moments take me longer to think through. So usually just starting from that one idea, whether it's so once I was obsessed with getting a red Smeg fridge. It was a real desire of mine, and a few people had said, that's a really crazy dream for you to have. And so I thought, yeah, I guess it is. I might write a prose poem. So it's those, I think often the quirky things kind of feel like prose poems when someone says to you, that's a bit odd. And you think, oh, well, maybe there's a prose poem in that. Prose poetry can be anything, any topic. It can be about Louisiana hot sauce, or it can be about, oppression, or it can be about something in the newspaper.
Literally, yeah. Okay. Well, let's go into the book you've chosen, because I'm guessing from there we'll be able to jump around anyway.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So your book of choice for today is?
Irradiated Cities by Mariko Nagai. Mm. And I love it because it's very different. It uses a range of colons in ways that suggest that things are connected and yet they're also separated. And so they're both joined and fragmented, even as you're reading kind of these moments. And it is a book that has black and white photographs in it. And Nagai uses four cities in Japan that have been affected by radiation to comment largely on the world before and after the atomic bomb. And it sounds terrible to say I'm interested in the atomic bomb, but it's been a macabre, I guess, interest in a way, learning and going. I've been to Hiroshima quite a lot, and learning from Habaksha how important it is that poets and creative people are able to talk about it in their work, because we don't want anyone to forget the devastation of atomic warfare. And I think it's Mariko Nagai does it so incredibly well. Because there's so many things I think you can do wrong with it. You can fall into appropriation. You can be perhaps too lighthearted. You could perhaps even be too dark about it all. But Nagai finds a way of using all kinds of archival material and newspapers to take fragments from real people, from their words and their thoughts and their ideas, and puts them into prose poetry that has these, little symbols. She uses quite a lot of brackets, but her main point is using colons to talk about fracture and rupture and how the world can never quite be the same since that moment. It's really powerful.
No, that's I love already even your description there. It's like, I'm so glad you did that, because I probably, if I'd read it, I'd be like, what's all these colons?
Yeah.
just skim past it. So exactly. I like being able to appreciate it more.
Yeah.
So is that because, it was the nuclear devastation, which is I don't think it's weird at all to be fascinated by it. It's probably the most defining feature. It changed the world. Like, it's very rare something changes the world so definitively.
Yeah.
And there's like such a clear moment, like that the bomb dropping, like, as in it's just, it's a completely different world after that. Like, that's the end of World War II, and it's kind of the end of world wars in the way that they were.
It is. And then you can't believe when you hear things like, Trump was in power in particular, we were hearing about his inclination to push the button to use the atomic bomb again. And you just feel like, with all of the information now that we have that's so devastating about what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in particular, you just can't imagine anyone would even think about going there.
Yeah, it's look, I think anything. Yeah, funnily enough, I've just finished listening to this podcast I listen to. It's called Hardcore History.
Yeah.
And he just did a five-part, it's about 20-hour series on the entire Japanese expansion and then shrinking over the course from like 1930s until 1945. And there is an element in there where, like, he's trying to be as like neutral about as possible in terms of like trying to be like not trying to defend it, but also trying to be like, I can see putting all the factors in place from a historical perspective of why it happened, essentially, and why the bomb got dropped, and how it was like, it wasn't a, like, to completely get you to understand why that decision was made at the time. which I thought was really interesting because, like, as in, you kind of hear it and you're like, oh, it's very easy to be clean cut about its use in that instance.
Yeah.
So I guess, yeah, because yeah, even at the time, like the fact that there was so much happening, and I'm still on the fence. Like, as in, I think the use of it is horrible, clearly, and any use of it is horrible, but I can understand its use at the time because of how much was going on around it at the same time. You know what
true,
I mean?
True, although Russia was Japan was going to be invaded anyway, and there was going to be an end, you know, to the war at that point. And America knew that. We have archives that show that, and a lot suggests that they just wanted to drop the atomic bomb to see what happened and to use the situation to their advantage to see what, you know, to use the Japanese as guinea pigs. It seemed like a good idea. And I think, you know, even
Russians,
if you,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And look, if you can't convince people of that, then the easiest thing that I say to them is, well, what's the explanation for Nagasaki? If you're okay with them dropping the bomb on Hiroshima, give me the reason why they did that with Nagasaki. And, oh, well, you know, they hadn't surrendered. I'm like, it was days. Like, come on, you know. So it's always a really difficult topic of conversation. I always talk about it when I'm writing a book on the atomic bomb maidens, who were women who were so horribly scarred in Hiroshima by the atomic bomb that a few of them were taken to America for plastic surgery. Like, it's just so dodgy, isn't it? It's like, oh, we'll make up for everything. We'll give some of these women plastic surgery. That'll make their lives better. Won't that be great? And so, yeah, so when I talk about it, I love the way that it fires people up, even if they don't agree with me and even if I don't agree with them, and we talk about whether the bomb should have been dropped, and they're like, oh, it saved so many more lives to drop the bomb, and you're like, no, it didn't. They could have just waited this amount of time. It's still nice that it gets people upset in a way, you know, whether it's whatever their opinion is about it. It's still something that I think should upset people, and it's good that it still does.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think, like, because people can fall into being like, oh, you're being a pacifist, whatever.
Yeah,
it's like, well, yeah, but
exactly.
I think maybe now that I'm thinking about it, even as you're saying that, I think probably my issue with it more than anything else is, like, the bomb almost lets everyone excuse the horrific firebombing that was happening constantly.
Yeah,
like,
true.
As in, they were already doing that true. Basically every day. So, like, the bomb actually wasn't that much more of a thing than what they were already doing, which isn't a justification. It's just like, we should actually acknowledge just how bad
all
what they were
it.
Doing for the 5 years was, not just
too.
This one moment. And that's
yeah.
part of, like, I think my angle coming in. I'm like, yeah, because, like, Dresden and stuff was maybe slightly less numbers, yes, but although probably not much less than Nagasaki. And that was happening
yeah.
like
except,
time, so.
I mean, and this is my coming from my angle. It's
yeah,
like,
I love this, yes.
How horrendous the death was after that, the cancer, the kind of way you died. Like, it's firebombing is horrible and there are plenty of excruciating deaths. But God, seeing some of the skin hanging off and people, you know, just living day to day wondering if they're going to get cancer and die, and so many of them did. And then in Japan, a whole range of issues where parents were trying to hide the effects if their children had been in any way exposed to the atomic bomb. You know, they didn't want them to get married because they might have children that were deformed. And it sort of seems to be such an ongoing problem, you know, and something that, you know, people checking their white blood cell counts every few months to see whether they had cancer, you know, years after the dropping of the bomb. That's just, it would be so hard to live like that.
Yeah, that part is, that's definitely the clear-cut difference. I've been to Hiroshima as well, and I went to that museum.
The museum? It's horrific, right? It's like, whew.
Yeah,
full
that's
on.
Why I walked out of that being like, you dogs, American, everyone forever. And then it's taken me like a long time to come around to, whilst not justifying it, realizing in the broader context, it's the end point of actually a very long period of horror. So almost like
it's not
a one-off. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think my husband couldn't make it to the top floor where they've renovated it now, but the top floor used to have, you know, bits of skin and hair and teeth and all of that in the big kind of specimen jars. And my husband's like, oh, this is so horrific, I can't deal with this. And I said, yeah, but that's good. That's part of the thing. You know, I'm okay. I can look at it and try and analyze it and think about it, and you're going to react emotionally and have to leave. And both of those are a great way to, you know, to approach the museum. But, yeah, it's quite shocking for people that don't know that they have these confronting photos and confronting specimens. You know, it is a shock to stumble upon it in the museum.
Yeah, it's a few. There's two that stick out. One's like in terms of just for
the
poetic
horror, yeah.
like spot. It's actually not gruesome, but it was a kid's tricycle.
Oh, yeah.
That's like rusted and destroyed and blackened and metal. Yep. And you're like, it's just such a contrast of those two things, which is obviously why they put it there.
Yeah.
And the other one was the man who was waiting at a bank to go into a bank, and there's just shadows all that's left.
Yeah.
And they've taken the whole front entrance and put it there. And you're like, this poor guy was sitting there waiting for a bank.
Yep.
Like,
it's amazing seeing the shadow, and you can see the outline and see what happened. The other one that fits in with that is the bento box. I always get really teary when I see that. It's a child's bento box, and the rice inside it is incinerated, and whatever the food was on the other side, there's just hardly any detail left. And his mother, I think, identified, you know, that it was him through this bento box that she found in, you know, what was remaining of his body and clothes and everything. And you know, it's a pretty powerful image, but it's, you know, that kind of loss of innocence in lots of ways.
Yeah, I think that contrast, exactly. It helps you highlight it easier than just a number. I guess with the books, obviously it's kind of painting a picture of this stuff, and you mentioned it also goes into Fukushima as well.
It does, yeah.
Which is, guess, is a different angle, or is it kind of the same? Is the book being like lecture-y in a way, or is it literally just snapshots of just these moments?
No, not at all. That's what I love about it. It's sort of it's repetitious, and it has this beautiful cadence to it, and it's just saying that things are different. It's saying this is what happened, and these are the horrific things, and we can't go back, and we have to acknowledge that we're a different world, you know, since radiation is, you know, through the atomic bombs, you know, affected our lives, and specifically the Japanese. And it's sort of using little images and moments to try and say things are probably never going to be the same, and we need to remember what's happened. And I guess, you know, it's sort of saying, well, yeah, there's Hiroshima, and that was a bombing, and then we've got Nagasaki, and there's one set in Tokyo, which was the fishing boat that was that got too close to the nuclear testing at Bikini Atoll, and then there's the Fukushima. So they're all different ways that radiation has affected and killed people and maimed people and all the rest of it. And it's sort of saying this has kind of become a part of our lives in a way that it shouldn't, and the way that we should think about the devastation, and yet it sort of still keeps happening. But it's not didactic at all. It's sort of, parts of it are kind of shocking, but parts of it are quite beautiful as well.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, if you're picking that as your favorite, I'm sure it's got a nice combination of both. Were you always, is this a topic that you find specifically interesting, or was it this book itself? I noticed you seem to have a bit of a Japanese focus in your studies. Is that?
I do. Yeah. I've loved it. Yeah. So I studied the film Hiroshima Mon Amour and read the script and was haunted by it, and started to become interested in going to Hiroshima and experiencing sort of being there. And the first time I went, I was quite young. I think I was in my early 20s, and I had a university scholarship to go there. And someone said to me, tread carefully, you're treading on bone dust. And it sort of always stuck with me. And I really do believe in the idea of genius loci. You've got to go somewhere and you've got to walk on that earth to kind of understand exactly what it feels like to be there. You know, Google Maps is great, but, you know, it's not the same as being there and understanding a place from walking on its surface, if you like. So I started to go many years and made a number of friends there, and as I said, started to speak to atomic bomb survivors, or Habaksha, about why they wanted to tell their stories and how they were getting older and how they were worrying that if their responses weren't written down or talked about, that they would be lost forever. And so I started to become interested in how I could help, and part of that was writing both critically and writing creatively about the atomic bomb. So yeah, I do both. And I am largely more interested in Hiroshima because it was the very first place, you know, that was bombed. Still interested in Nagasaki as well, but I guess my specialization is more around the city of Hiroshima.
Yeah, I mean, that's I'm sure, I hope it's better now, but I do know that I that I feel like some people wouldn't even know about Nagasaki.
I feel sorry for them because they always say that. Everyone talks about Hiroshima, but, you know, what about Nagasaki?
Yeah,
it is tricky.
So that's kind of been the focus, like, yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Can you speak Japanese?
Only conversational, basic conversational stuff. I have done some Japanese translation, which has been fascinating. So it was part of a group that went to Japan, and we met up with Japanese poets, and they translated our poems into Japanese, and we translated their poems into English with the help of a translator. So we, and many of the Japanese poets spoke English, but just didn't think that they had the kind of poetic skills in English to translate them themselves. So we worked in different ways in translation, and it was, you know, really, really fascinating to enter that world of translation as well.
Yeah, well, that's because, like, it would be because of how much the language itself is part of the, it's not just the words, it's also just like how they sound and all that stuff. It would be like, yeah, anyone who could translate like that, that would be a complex task, trying to capture.
You know, it makes you think about your own words and your own poems in such different ways. Like, I remember saying to one of the Japanese poets, oh, you know, the best word for this would be space. You know, we are in this space together, for example, is one of the lines of her poems. And she's like, oh, space, that's like aliens. And I'm like, no, that's outer space. And she's like, oh, no, space to us means like aliens. But I'm like, okay. Different words have different meanings, and we don't think about them, and they think about them on a different level, you know, when you're translating.
So it
made me think about all kinds of the meanings of all kinds of words and what we think of them and how they can be interpreted by other people. It's probably good for my own work.
To think more about words.
That's right. You know, like you said, you can't even get through a few lines of a book without worrying about, oh, am I really looking at the alliteration here or what that image means? So now you've got even more of a challenge to get through a few words.
It's like you just want to find more tasks for yourself.
That's it. I never get through a book. Just spend the whole time worried about the words and imagery.
That's true, actually. It's kind of two different kinds of reading, right? One is like getting the story, and then the other one's actually sitting there and actually appreciating it. I think I find it really interesting, and like just you've loved this thing as in prose poetry, and you've just done it your whole life.
Yep. I'm one of the few people that only write prose poetry. A lot of people write prose poetry in addition to verse. But
sell out.
No, it just doesn't grab me. Yeah, like I have not tired of the form. I find there's so many things you can do with it. It's not the same all the time. I'm not just, you know, pushing out the same kind of little block of text. There's always challenges. There's always differences. There's always a new way to push the boundaries. And I think, you know, so for me, I'm still endlessly thrilled by it, whereas other people might think, oh, I've done that. I've done a few prose poems. I understand what that is. And that's fine too. But I'm still locked in the kind of wonder of it, and what it can do is still interesting to me.
Mm. And is that, I guess now to go back to the inspiration for this stuff, were you growing up in like quite a poetic household, I guess?
No, not at all. I guess my Nana enjoyed poetry, but she loved Banjo Paterson and Dorothea McKellar, and she, you know, I guess when I was little I could recite The Man from Snowy River, which everyone thought was, you know, the greatest party trick when I was four or something crazy like that. But no,
that's a lot more than me, trust me. It's a lot more poetic than most people by the sound of it already.
Certainly it was probably my literature teacher that first got me interested. I think teachers can be really important if they're really wonderful people. It was probably not until I was in year nine, I had an English teacher called Mary Holmes, and then I had her again in year 11 and 12 for literature, and she really taught me the passion and love of poetry, which my family still don't have to this day. Like, they're just not that interested. Even my husband's like, poetry, I'm not reading that. I'm like, can't you read my latest book? And he's like, oh, can't you just tell me what it's about instead? But that's okay too.
All right. Is it your husband's not in the writing field or anything like that?
He's a historian.
Pretty funny. Actually, so I think just quickly before we get off, so you studied at Harvard as well. Is that right?
Or? I was there as a year for a year as a visiting scholar. So I had a Stephen Greenblatt, who's this incredible, amazing, famous scholar there, as my sponsor. And so I spent a year there doing research. I was doing research into public intellectuals. I was pretty excited to interview some really amazing people while I was there earlier, and sort of came back and talked to them. So I'd done some interviews prior to the year at Harvard with Noam Chomsky, Camille Paglia, and a range of people, and Harold Bloom, and people that were really interesting to me.
Wow, those are some big names.
No, it was terrifying and wonderful. And so when I put them together in a book of interviews and wanted to do more about public intellectuals as a result of doing those interviews and publishing those interviews. And so then decided that it would be best to try and do it through Harvard and access their resources and have the intellectual community there to talk to about public intellectualism and all of that. So sort of went through a application process and was lucky enough to be accepted for a year there. I did attend and teach a few of the classes on Australian and did, you know, oh, the Australian can talk about Australian poetry. So that was fun.
That's such a good claim to fame.
Yeah.
Just taught at Harvard, yeah.
That's it. And spent, you know, great times researching in the library, and there's lots of libraries. There's the famous, you know, big Widener library, but there's also a great library called the Houghton, and they have like little specialist collections of things. And I found it, you know, really inspiring, a really inspiring year, sort of living that way as well, living with the research in my head and not having to deviate from it and multitask and do a million other things. It was really satisfying just to, you know, live in it and be in it and think about it all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And having the community there who are all like-minded and also ridiculously hardworking and passionate and all that stuff would just be, I could only imagine. Cool. I guess we've jumped around a fair bit, but I think that's...
Sorry, I probably made it so hard for you, haven't I? We've just like not followed a trajectory.
No, that's great. Anyway. Look, it's probably like some forms of poetry, I guess.
Okay. Together in a box.
Exactly. I'll actually one last thing quickly. You mentioned public intellectuals. Now, this is just me going, we might not even put this in the podcast, to be honest. I'm just interested.
No, whatever you like.
When you say public intellectuals, you're talking about like basically anyone who's very smart, who's like got a public persona. So there's certain people who fall into that field who are like kind of more well-known and less well-known. Is that like, do you feel like that happens naturally, or do you reckon they plan it, or like what was the view when you're saying you were studying it? What was like the idea? Yeah. What were you looking into?
I wanted to really see what their thoughts were about that kind of public arena, especially because the public intellectuals that I interviewed were all attached to universities, like they all worked at universities. And I wanted to know how free they were in terms of what they're allowed to say, you know, that whole idea of freedom of speech. You know, Noam Chomsky says some pretty explosive things in the press. You know, is MIT going to kick him out for saying those things? Mm. So I was kind of interested to see what their public engagements were compared to sort of what their academic engagements were. And they all, you know, pretty universally said that their universities were incredibly supportive. And even if the university's view was not the same as their view, they appreciated the fact that, you know, that person was speaking out on an issue in the public, and that they supported them despite whether they were most of the universities there have a more kind of conservative frame, I think, than some of the things that the public intellectuals were saying. Yeah, it's sort of perhaps a little different here. I guess I was sort of trying to find the Australian public intellectuals, and they're just sort of very different. And a lot of them are historians rather than people, I guess. You know, I was really interested in Harold Bloom and Camille Paglia because, you know, they both come out of English departments and were both talking about literature and how literature can sort of change the world, and drawing on it in their discussions in the public arena. So they were kind of fascinating and larger than life personalities. I think to be a public intellectual, you've got to have some of that. You've got to be compelling, even if it's in a challenging kind of way.
Yeah.
You've still got to want to listen to you, even if they get fired up or they don't like what you've got to say, or they do.
Mm. And I guess, to go on that point, though, I guess Australia, I don't know. Do Australians want intellectuals? I don't even know if they do.
I think that's true. I mean, it's true, isn't it? Like, I think, you know, we want sporting, you know, legends. Do we want public intellectuals? Not as much. Mm. And I, you know, it's a tricky one. It's certainly we have a number of them, and we have had over time a number of them. But do we take them as seriously as other traditions? Probably not.
Mm. That's now that I think about it, definitely. I think there's that classic tall poppy thing. So it's like public intellectual. What, yeah. You think you're so smart?
Exactly. I think that you see that in schools, and that students don't want to. I don't want to look smart, miss. And you're like, oh, why not? Oh, I'll be. You know, people won't like me. No one will play with me if I, you know, if I'm smart.
That's a heartbreaking thing to have to hear.
That's it.
Okay. Well, on that, that's a bit of a grim note to finish on.
Yeah, no, we should finish on a grim note.
We're gonna make it. No, that's what this is about. We're spreading the word. We're getting more people out there. Sure. Like, apparently, like, this is a slight tangent, but apparently, like, the Australia from a book point of view, like the top selling book some years is like adult coloring books.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
We've got a bit of work to do.
We have.
But thank you so much for being on and giving me the time to chat through all
this. It's been fun. Thank you for having me.
It's been great. Is there anyone should catch you anywhere? Anything you want to give a shout out to? Anything like that?
I host a American poetry reading series in Australia. It's on Sunday mornings called Lit Balm, and it started in America as a way of dealing with the pandemic. It was supposed to be the anodyne to the pandemic and what was going on across the world, and it's been really fascinating doing that because I've encountered so many wonderful people from all over the world because everyone can Zoom, so that's been fun. So yeah, check it out.
I'll put a link to that.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
All right, great. Well, thanks very much. We'll catch you around.
Thank you.
Cheers.
See ya.